So my favorite four habits are what I call the four M's of mental health, but there really are any number. And what I like about the four M's is that it's simple, 10 to 15 minutes, and they are, 10 to 15 minutes a day or 10 to 15 minutes a week, whatever you can pull, but they are habits unto themselves. But then they're also habits that really optimize your mental and physical well-being so that you can take on more challenges.
Welcome to Radical Vitality, a podcast dedicated to helping you find more health, joy, and radical vitality in body and mind, despite the challenges of modern life. I'm your host, Kanchan Koya, a PhD in biomedical sciences, turned cookbook author, health and nutrition coach, and passionate advocate of the use of spices, functional foods, nutrition, and lifestyle for better health. Join me and top experts in women's health as we navigate what has become an all too complicated landscape when it comes to health and wellness, so we can get down to what really matters, so you can enjoy that life of radical vitality you so deserve. Now, on to today's episode. My guest today is Dr. Sue Varma, a distinguished psychiatrist and cognitive behavioral therapist here in New York City, as well as clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU. Dr. Varma is the author of the just released Practical Optimism, which, as she explains in today's episode, is a unique mindset and skill set, a conscious choice, and a daily practice. In today's episode, you will learn how to cultivate practical optimism so you can become a resourceful, realistic, and thoughtful problem solver who possesses something of rare value, inner resources to cope during a crisis and to use it as fuel to flourish. If you want to experience greater meaning, mastery, and acceptance, keep listening as Dr. Varma guides us through her revolutionary 8-pillar framework to help us get to this mindset of practical optimism, which is a scientific and tangible pathway to boosting health, happiness, resilience, success, and yes, even our longevity. Dr. Sue Varma, Sue, thank you so much for being a guest on Radical Vitality. So excited to have you.
Thank you. So great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on your book that is out as this episode is out. And it's a real gift to the world. What a fantastic title. I was super intrigued and I cannot wait to jump into Practical Optimism. Sounds like something we all need. But before we go there, I would love to know your origin story when it comes to your work in psychiatry. What sparked your interest in this field?
Yes. So, you know, I feel like I hope that I would have come to it eventually, but I feel really blessed that I grew up in a family that really valued the study of health and wellness and medicine. My father is a child psychiatrist, and he was one of the first child psychiatrists in northern India. And that's actually how my parents met. My mom had started a school with children with learning disabilities and mental health problems, and was helping mainstream these kids into regular classrooms, which wasn't done back then in the 1960s. So he was doing his training in the United States. He heard about the work she was doing in New Delhi, and two of the first three prime ministers of India had gotten involved and had made the school as like a model of what mental health should look like when it's integrated into classrooms, which is in India in the 1960s, really anywhere in the world in the 1960s was unheard of. So, you know, they were pioneers in their field there. Then they came to the United States and continued their work and their passion. So I grew up going to psychiatry meetings, and patients would always come up to my dad and say, you know, you changed my life. And I was like, what does this man do? And what is so magical? And people would say, because of him, I have a job, I have a family. And so even though I couldn't go because these sessions are confidential, I really felt that there was something beautiful about getting help, being vulnerable, asking for help when you need it, and then taking control and having agency in your life, which is something so huge. And that stuck with me because these are folks who might have, you know, struggled with addiction or very complex trauma or abuse, you know, or mental health challenges. So I felt like, wow, there are things that you can learn and do that can change your life. And so that stuck with me at a very young age. And then I'm always also fascinated by science and medicine, the people. So really that's, if I had to say one word why I got into all of this, it's like I love people so much and I want to give back and use my passion for their benefit.
Wow, what a beautiful and inspiring intention and such important work and so impactful. And I'm sure it's just so rewarding to see the impact of what you do in real time with people. You know, I really feel like, especially as someone from a South Asian background like yourself, mental health and conversations around mental health, at least when I was growing up, you know, in the 80s, 90s, was reserved for like a small sliver of the population that really had like challenges. And the rest of us were supposed to just kind of get on with it, you know, think positive, just snap out of any kind of like moodiness or even negative emotions. And I feel like we are in a time where there is so much more awareness around the importance of mental health for everyone, not just for people who might be having more severe mental illness. But at the same time, while there is this growing awareness, I also feel like maybe I'm imagining it, but that mental ill health is also at an all-time high for the average person because of the world we live in, social media, so many factors. And in your practice, would you say that you feel like mental health issues are on the rise, or would you feel, do you feel like there's actually been an improvement because of greater awareness?
Yes, such a great question. And it's so complex because on one hand, I would say, okay, maybe we are diagnosing people more because they're more likely to seek help. So is it just the fact that we're noticing it more now, or people are talking about it more? So I think that is a part of it. It's just that there is more education and awareness, and maybe that's why we're seeing it. But at the same time, there really is something happening, a change in society in the last 20 to 30 years, where people, the fabric of our society, which is other people, has kind of broken down, where people have moved away from their families of origin. There's a lot of estrangement. People aren't keeping in touch with family members, especially in the United States, and they're moving away for work, for opportunities. And then they're also prioritizing what we call like hustle culture of I need to succeed. And what that's happening is putting relationships and bonds of friendship on the back burner. And then add in social media and the need for achievement, you know, times 100. It's like on steroids. And so even young people are spending less time face to face. Like they say, the average student in high school or less is spending less than 40 minutes a day with other people because of academic pressure, because of pressure to succeed in sports. So they're getting it from every direction, and they don't have the bomb, which is the social relationships that we once had. So definitely, it's both that we're recognizing it, but also it's mental health problems are on the rise. And this idea of like, you need to fix it yourself. In fact, the CDC saw suicide rates go up 30% in 30 years from the 1990s onwards, because they're like, people feel this need to be hyper self-reliant, hyper independent, don't need to ask for help. You got to figure it out yourself.
Yeah, so much to chew on. Hustle culture. I love that because I feel like there was a time when we were celebrating hustle culture. You know, the famous song when I was in college, like every day I'm hustling.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, oh my gosh, maybe it's too much. Like, do we really need to be hustling all the time? So I definitely want to talk more about hustle culture. So this brings us to your book, and which is really intended to be a solution to the mental health crisis that is complicated and multifactorial. Practical optimism. What is practical optimism, and what made you write a book about it?
Yes. So, you know, first of all, I want to say that if anyone is experiencing a mental health crisis, you know, please seek help, because the book is only going to be one part of it, right? One part of a comprehensive treatment plan, if you will. And really, it's about life skills. And through the lens of optimism, how can we develop better emotional regulation, better emotional awareness, having more intention about what we do, how to develop healthy habits, and distilling all this idea of good mental health and making it super actionable. And what we are finding is that optimists naturally are predisposed to a lot of success in mental health, because not only do optimists have positive outlooks, they're able to deliver positive outcomes through action steps. And so telling somebody, just get over it, look on the bright side, To me, that's toxic positivity. That's the woo-woo, almost what we call toxic optimism or impractical optimism, is just wishing and wanting. Like if somebody's like, oh, you know, you have diabetes, your cholesterol is elevated, you're going to be at risk for heart attack. A toxic optimist might be like, nah, it'll be fine. I'll be fine. You worry too much. You know, and we all have family members who are like, yo, it's in your head. You worry too much. I'll be fine. No, practical optimists take the information in a situation like that and say, all right, what can I do? This sucks. I'm not happy to hear this diagnosis or this negative situation in my life, but what can I do? And they will seek the resources. They will seek the help because they value themselves. Optimists live 20% longer than the average person because of certain habits, from dental health to mental health. They take care of themselves. They go to annual screenings. They believe in the concept of prevention. They'll invest time, energy, money, effort, resources into taking care of themselves. They have better habits. So I want people to think of practical optimism as a practice. Like you have a yoga practice, you have a meditation practice, you have a journaling practice, you have a sports, language, anything you're learning. Some days it's 5 minutes, some days it might be an hour. But I want this book to be, you know, by your bedstand, on your phone, wherever it is that you read and consume information, and come back to it. Come back to it as a manual sort of on life to accompany you on this journey.
I love so many things you said. You said practical optimism is something you can learn and cultivate. It's not something you either are or are not, which reminds me of, you know, this idea of the growth mindset. So often we think like, so-and-so is an optimist, so lucky, life must be good through their lens, you know, through the glasses that they view the world with. But what you're saying is we can all cultivate practical optimism. And I love that you draw that distinction about not being in denial. Like you're not like, oh yeah, I have diabetes, it'll be fine. That's actually, like you said, like impractical, unrealistic, kind of toxic optimism.
Yes.
What we want is awareness, self-awareness, awareness of the situation, but then these practices that can be cultivated, and it's not like you have them or you don't.
Yes, exactly. And you know, what's interesting is, you know, just what you said is about whether you have it or not, the optimist and pessimist go through the same number of negative life events. So bad things happen to both of them. It's not that they're lucky because bad things don't happen to them. They are just able to handle them better because they're equipped with certain skills that come more naturally to them. And when we look at some of the studies, it was very interesting to see the genetic basis of optimism. And this is a little bit controversial because some new studies have contradicted it or said it's not applicable to the general population. But what they found is that optimism is linked to the oxytocin receptor gene, which codes for oxytocin, cuddle bonding and hormone involved in social emotional learning. And that if you have a certain gene, you two copies of this specific variant, you'll be fine, you'll be optimistic, less depression. And if you have any variations in it, one or two copies of something else, you might be more likely to have depression and pessimism. And so that was so interesting to me that it validates the fact that some people, sure, will be genetically predisposed to looking at things a certain way. But the second part of the study, and to me the most interesting part, was that what optimism really codes for is certain psychological resources, coping mechanisms, and skills. So I became fascinated by this topic when I was working with 9/11 survivors and resilience. And in the research of resilience, what I found is that optimism is one of the key features of resilience that no one is talking about, that has so much robust science, that optimistic people have less heart attacks, less stroke, they live longer, they make more money, they have more productive work situations, they get along better with their coworkers, they have happier marriages. So then I was like, oh my God, no one is talking about this. If I could give someone like the fountain of health, this is what it would be. And this is where you should park all your resources. And there's a lot more study happening, but that optimism, you can give people 10 to 15 minute optimism interventions and change the outcome of a test, for example. So students that have failed a test, and if you do like, you know, some sort of a control where you do nothing with them, and the other students where you give them either an optimism intervention or journaling or self-compassion, all of the things that I talk about in this book, you can affect the outcome. And these kids, instead of failing or doing a little bit better, do significantly better because they come with a sense of agency of like, all right, stuff happens, I'm going to try again.
So empowering. So how do more of us who may not be genetically programmed to be optimistic, or even those of us who are optimistic but want to hone that skill further, how do we become more practical optimists?
Yes. So, you know, first, the first thing is just having awareness, because a lot of times people are not even aware of their tendency and they're like, but I'm just this way. This is my personality. And so I would say the first thing is just take some distance from your thoughts. You are not your thoughts, right? Like, think of your thoughts as, I say, like a baggage at an airport baggage carousel that they go by, and other people's baggage, you're not investing in them. You're not picking them up. You notice them. So if you have a negative thought, say, huh, interesting. I'm going to be aware of that. Interesting. I'm going to note that. I'm not going to invest to it. I'm not going to attach to it. But instead, maybe I can challenge it. And Kanchan, this is something I had to learn in my own therapy. So as a psychiatry resident, all of us were encouraged to go at some point or another. And I waited and I was like, therapy is so expensive. My program does not pay for it. I don't have the time. I'm working 100 hours a week at 5 different hospitals. And it wasn't until I experienced, you know, sort of a little mini crisis, and I talk about this in the book, that finally I became a therapist ready for therapy. And when I sought my own therapy, it was the best thing I ever did, not only to help myself, not only to help my patients, but to equip me with tools for life. And one of them was the ability to talk back to your thoughts. And so pessimists have a tendency to do these three things very common. When bad things happen to them, they say, it's my fault. They personalize it. It's about me. Someone doesn't like me. They didn't get back to my email. My job didn't, my boss didn't give me the promotion. It's my fault. I suck. I'm a loser. And what they did right there is character assassinate themselves. It's my fault. I suck right now. I'm a loser. So they make it pervasive. It's all aspects of my life I suck in, and they make it permanent. All things will never get better. And I know that sounds a little extreme, but all of us do it, you know, like, oh my God, my friend didn't respond to me. Oh, I must've offended them. Oh, why do I put my foot in my mouth? I always do this. I failed a science exam. Oh, I'm not meant to go into science. So being aware of thought patterns is one big way to practice optimism. And I give people steps about how to challenge that negative thought. So what would you say to a friend? Would you be this harsh to a friend? No, you would be like, you know what? Get yourself a tutor, right? You would take practical advice from them. You would seek a mentor. So I have tons of like 100 plus tangible advice for every aspect of your life, from negative thinking, how to change that, to problem solving, how to be more active and proactive, and like a 25 question list if you're having a career change and you don't know what to do, you're at a crossroads. So, you know, how to be more engaged and interactive with yourself, how to set intentions, how to have a purpose, how to execute on that purpose. Is your purpose small p, like what's my purpose in this relationship, in this job, in this moment? Or what's my big P purpose of like in life?
Yeah. So I've heard you say you have 8 pillars that you outline in the book that are really intended to help people cultivate more practical optimism. And you mentioned some of them. You know, I would love your thoughts on negative emotions and feelings, because I feel like, again, going back to my cultural upbringing, you know, growing up, there was a lot of toxic optimism just being sort of thrown our way culturally. Like, if you're having a bad day or you're having negative feelings, it's like, snap out of it. You have so much to be grateful for. Focus on the positive, which has its strengths. But as we're learning, you know, some of those negative feelings, I mean, feelings are part of a human experience, right? And not all feelings are positive. Sometimes they're negative. And we as a culture can sometimes really shun the negative and see them as bad, but they are part of the human experience. So how does one walk the fine line between not sort of drowning in the negative thoughts and the negative feelings, but still allowing space for what is a full human experience?
Yes. And I love that you say that, because they really are part of our human experience. And I think, you know, when one of the things that we can do is start develop, like even in our home environments, a culture that allows for conversation around feelings and that isn't scared off by them. Because that's what I'm hearing is like, sometimes when we don't hold space for other people, we find either our own emotions or theirs inconvenient, or we don't know how to handle it. You know, I see this a lot with parents and kids, where the kid is like, I'm really upset. And the parent's like, but it's like 9:30 p.m. or 10 o'clock and you're supposed to be in bed. And why are you talking to me about this now? Or whatever your equivalent in your life is. And So even 5 minutes is what a person needs in that situation, is to feel seen and heard and validated, and it can make such a difference. So I would say, rather than ruminate in your own head, say to yourself, first of all, what am I feeling? And I have this quick tip in the book. It's called name it, claim it, tame it, and reframe it. And then naming is like, okay, what happened? Because a lot of times we're carrying stress all day long. Something might have happened. Maybe there was a rejection or a disappointment in our work or in our home or in our relationship, and we're carrying it, but we're not identifying it. So identify the trigger and say, the people who can identify and get super granular about the trigger and something we called affect labeling, like labeling the emotions, their mental health is so much better. So instead of their stress manifesting in the form of headaches or frequent urination or bowel syndromes or insomnia or fatigue, which is how a lot of people's stress manifests, instead, they'll be able to point and say, this happened on this date at this time. This person said this to me, and it really fill in the blank. Hurt my feelings, made me feel very small. And as a result of it, I was clenching in my jaw and my shoulders, my heart started racing. And then that's the naming it and claiming it. And then the taming it is, what is going to be your go-to? How are you going to release those negative emotions? Are you going to call a friend and say, hey, do you mind? I just need 10 minutes of your time. Are you going to keep a journal? People who write in their journal, you don't even have to have a fancy journal, just get a scrap paper and write anything you want about how you're feeling. And the point is, you're getting it out and you're identifying it, you're labeling it, you're connecting it to a situation, and you don't even have to come up with a solution. And then later you can do deep breathing, you can do meditation, you can walk. Walking is such a great distraction. Funny memes, as long as you're not going to endlessly scroll. Walking forces you to get out of your head. And then it's something called optic flow, where you have to look left and right. Swimming, for me, I love to swim in the ocean. I love to swim in the pool. Always helps my stress, helps me be more creative. I then come out and I have tons of ideas that I want to write about. And then the reframing, if and when you feel strong enough to do that, because in the midst of crisis, you're like, I just got shat on right now. Like, I'm not going to reframe anything. I'm not looking for the positive in this moment. 100% fine. But if it's still nagging with you, then say, okay, how can I come back? And is there anything that I can see as a silver lining? Is there anything positive? And if not, say, all right, is this going to matter 5 years from now? Probably not. What is the utility and in me feeling this way? And that was a question I ended up asking a lot of my patients who are survivors of trauma, because they'll say to me, A, I can't find anything positive in this situation. And I say, 100%, I agree with you. And they're like, B, this really bad thing that happened to me could happen again. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. It can happen again. And so the only thing we're left with in that situation is, what is the utility of carrying around this negative emotion at this point? You know, so if it's about forgiving someone only just in your own mind to yourself, just for yourself, is it about writing a letter to that person that did you wrong and you're never going to send it? So think of little ways that health in a healthy way allow you to express emotions without necessarily needing to solve the problem. And then when you're ready, you'll come to it and you'll be better rested. Get sleep. Don't compromise on your sleep, on your exercise during periods of stress and negative emotions. And also recognize that by definition, emotions are fleeting. Yes, emotions can last. They can become mood states. And if they last for 2 or more weeks, then think about depression and talking to your primary care doctor or getting a therapist. But by definition, they're fleeting. And so if you can understand that impermanence, you know, and I think that's what the Eastern wisdom is about. Like, yes, there definitely is a toxic side of it, because they don't create the room for the yes and. It's just like, forget it. But the beauty of what I've learned now to blend sort of Eastern and Western wisdom and science and philosophy is that everything is impermanent, right? Mm-hmm. So even this, like, you know, they say this too shall pass, both the good and the bad will pass.
Yeah, I love that framework of naming it and claiming it, because I think what it does too is it separates the thought or the emotion from your core being. And it's something you were saying, like, so often pessimists can kind of, you know, conflate a negative emotion or a negative feeling with just something negative about themselves. Like, I'm a bad person because I'm constantly stuck in these negative loops. And when you name it and claim it, it's like you're creating like a separation. Like, I'm a person having a negative thought or having a negative feeling. That doesn't make me, you know, there's less sort of shame associated with that
kind of naming and claiming.
Yes. And there's also more self-compassion in that you're saying, like you said, I'm having a human experience and this is normal and this is part of the realm. And there's some acceptance. So what it does is there's mindfulness, mindful observation of what you're feeling. Then there's an acceptance of what you're feeling. And then the last part is common humanity, which is all of us feel this way. I'm not alone. And all of this, what these three steps do is then prepare you for action so that you don't dwell in the pessimism, because it's easy when you shame. And I did a lot of research on the difference between shame and guilt. And I'm so fascinated by this because guilt, for the most part, as long as if it's in small doses, it gives you actionable steps and it gives you an opportunity for reparation. It says, I did something wrong and I want to correct it. Shame, on the other hand, paralyzes you, makes you passive because you don't want to look at what you did. You're like, oh my God, I can't even. And you become paralyzed. And shame more often leads to depression and pessimism, and it keeps you stuck and you ruminate, and it's a downward spiral. It does not bring you back. And if you can be self-compassionate and you can say, all right, I screwed up. All right, I look like a fool. I said the wrong thing. It's totally fine. But that's where the practical part comes in, is I want you to take responsibility. If you did mess up, it's okay. If you can't follow through on your habits and you're like, oh my God, I had New Year's resolutions and they're over already. Totally fine. Let's regroup, take a break, hit pause, not stop.
Love that. So I know you have 8 pillars, and I hope everyone picks up the book and does a deep dive and keeps the book on their nightstand so they can pick it up and really continue to cultivate the skill of practical optimism. But if there was one or two pillars from the 8 that you felt like, you know, just the everyday person, let's talk to my audience, which is predominantly women, a lot of moms who experience overwhelm, mom guilt, you know, their sense of purpose is shifting because right now it might be the season of young kids and their purpose is just to be the best mother they can. But then they also have aspirations for their own careers and their own interests and hobbies. What would be a couple of pillars that you feel like people could start to implement, you know, women could start to implement right now to build a more optimistic mindset?
Yes. So, you know, one of the pillars is about purpose. And I always say that your purpose doesn't have to come from your paycheck. Your purpose can be from anything that you're doing that brings you joy. And if that is taking care of your kids, taking care of your family, even taking a break to figure it out, 100% okay. The second thing is that your purpose, if you can't find it, so to speak, totally fine. I want you to create it. And for me, part of creating purpose is putting the cart before the horse. And it's a tip called behavioral activation that therapists use when somebody's like, I'm lost, or I can't find pleasure in the things that I once used to. So it means taking chances, getting outside your comfort zone. Does that mean if you're, let's say, toying with a career transition or starting something new? You know, what I love about Instagram, right, is that we're all connected. You know, reach out to someone and say, I love what you're doing. And how can I be a part of your journey? Offer somebody else help, you know, and often our purpose comes from connecting our passion to our purpose, but through service. So to say, I love what you're doing. How can I be of help to you? And then all of a sudden you form a genuine connection, because so many people these days are inundated with everybody, let's say, asking them for something. And if you're able to offer to say, we have these mutual interests, or can I shadow you? How can I learn? Or go to the talks, or listen to the podcast, or listen. So sometimes it's about figuring out what is my next step and then seeing what are you good at and what would you do for free? And by no means am I saying do something for free, like you should get paid fairly. But at the same time, that gives you the secret as to what lights you up. And I love this Japanese concept of ikigai, with that Venn diagram where your passion, purpose, mission, vocation all align. So what am I good at? What does the world need? You know, there's so many people I know who are like, I'm really creative. I'm very good with fill in the blank. I don't know, interior design, cooking, like being a content creator, or I don't know yet, or there's pieces of it, or I like it, but not enough to make it a career. So that's totally fine. And also recognize that your purpose from 10 years ago isn't going to be your purpose today, and your purpose today isn't going to be your purpose tomorrow. And so it's totally fine if you're not able, if you have young kids and you're not able right now to have that full-fledged career, stop comparing yourself. I think that's also really tough, where somebody, I know a lot of women who are like, you know, I spent, quote, my best years. Like, your best years are like often your reproductive years, right? But here's the thing, it's never too late to start. Like I had an idea of writing a book for so many years, right? I started at least not this book, but a different idea 10 to 15 years ago. And I had taken a class on had first bought a book, how to write a book proposal, and then took a class on how to write the book proposal and made friends and stayed in contact. And one of those women ended up being someone I reached out to almost more than a decade later to say, hey, can you help me if I need some editing or whatever? So what I'm saying is it's okay to plant seeds if that's all you can do. You know, at that time I was the medical director of a program. I was working full time and I was doing a lot of different things in media. And then later on ended up having my own kids and there was always something and I came back to it, you know, and couldn't do it, you know, when my kids were super young. So the point is there's something else called successive approximations. They're like little steps that you're doing that are shaping, learning, teaching, and you're moving closer to your goal. But don't lose hope and faith. Right now, in this moment in time, might not be the right time, but come back to it. Don't give up. Plant the seeds now because I will guarantee you, if you do something small, consistent, there will be payoff. So don't give up. And it's okay to try different things, to say, I did that, not for me. Good to know. I have a patient that I work with who has a full-time job and marketing, like very high up, but felt like all I'm doing is I'm giving money into the corporation. Like, what am I doing for myself? And then she took time off and explored a bunch of, different journeys in the healing space, then did real estate. And then was like, you know what? None of this is for me, you know, and it's totally fine to be like, I don't want to do any of this. Instead, I want to create my own business, which has nothing to do with the last four jobs that I had. And that's 100% okay.
I love this quote that I often remind myself with, which is something like, ask not what the world needs, but ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs is more people who have come alive. And you talked about this idea of purpose as sparking joy and being inspiring to you and the fact that it can change over time. And you may have to work on something slowly during a season of your life so it can manifest in another season of your life. So I think that's super empowering and inspiring, especially I know for mothers who are feeling, you know, like there's only 24 hours in the day.
Yes. Yeah.
So a lot of what we talk about on this podcast is health and wellness, sort of habits and, you know, hacks and tips and practices. Are there sort of habits or things that one can do just from a physical health perspective that really support the cultivation of a more optimistic mindset?
Yes. So my favorite four habits are what I call the four M's of mental health, but there really are any number. And what I like about the four M's is that it's simple, 10 to 15 minutes, and they are, you know, 10 to 15 minutes a day or 10 to 15 minutes a week, whatever you can pull, but they are habits unto themselves. But then they're also habits that really optimize your mental and physical well-being so that you can take on more challenges and take on more habits. So if you said I would tell you these four M's, plus I would add in sleep and diet. So the four M's are movement, mindfulness, mastery, and meaningful engagement. And what I mean by meaningful engagement is those deep, authentic, vulnerable conversations where you have with someone where there's no phone on the table, you have time, and you're asking the person, like, how are you really, really doing? Like, what's going on in your life? Tell me about X, Y, and Z. I remember you told me this last time. How has that been going for you? How is the job? How is the child? How is the family? So asking questions and then listening to the answers and then giving empathic responses, validating them, being emotionally attuned to the emotions. I'm hearing you say this. Is that correct? So being a good listener, people who have active listeners in their life live on average 4 years longer. They have less dementia and cognitive problems. So invest in being a good listener and invest in surrounding yourself with very good listeners. So to me, those are meaningful engagements. But you can also have what I call social snacking or micro connections. So on the going to the grocery store, the barista, the dog walker, having pleasant exchanges with people, even if they're light and don't lead to anything. But then when you do meet someone that you connect with, please follow up. And it's never too late to follow up to say, hey, I really enjoyed meeting you 6 months ago. I'm so sorry I dropped the ball. Can we grab coffee sometime? Like, I'd like to continue and get to know you better. So don't be afraid of that. Mindfulness can be in any form that you feel that you can do something single-mindedly. It doesn't have to be meditation, but it would be great. It could be you washing your dishes, but not doing anything else. Okay, if you want to listen to Kanchan's podcast, do that. But otherwise, be in the moment. And if you're playing with, you know, like even if a lot of times moms have the guilt, because I know I have this of like, you know, my kid, my younger one wants to play Uno. And I'm like, I don't have time to play seven games of Uno with him, right? But I want to play one. And I'll be like, okay, let me finish my work and I'm going to play one. So keep it small. It could be 10 minutes of, you're not going to do anything. There's no phones. You're not going to do, like, you're fully present. Mastery is doing something just for the sake of it that gives you, puts you in a state of flow, and you're doing it single-mindedly. And I was asked recently by the New York Times to give, they had a 6-day well challenge. And I was, the book and the advice from the book was in 2 days of them. How do you get more energy? And what's interesting is no one is thinking of flow states. It was called low stakes flow states, and something that nobody cares about. She asked me, the journalist, Jan Sidon, the editor, was like, what do you do? And I said, salsa dancing. And this was something that helped me, like, in my longest, most grueling days during my medical training, of like going, you know, taking a salsa dancing class. And like, the point is, you don't have to be a master to experience mastery. For some people, it's cooking, it's gardening, golfing, you name it, pottery, whatever puts you in the zone where you forget about anything else in the world and you come alive and you feel immersed and you're in one with it. And then movement. And again, like we talked about social snacking, think about social, like exercise snacking, 10 or 15 minutes, whatever. And one thing I'm finding is that people who have provisions at home to be able to exercise are more likely to do it, because there's kind of like no excuse. So having the weights, the yoga mat, an exercise band, and saying, you know what, I'm going to put on, different people follow different influencers, different YouTubers, but they have their favorite. But what I love is that some people have, okay, this is my 10 minute go-to exercise. This is my 20 minute. This is my 15 minute. So the more you can give yourself options, and they always say that perfect is the enemy of the good. Don't keep your expectations too high in the beginning. Keep them realistic. And the consistency is more important in the beginning, because then you can sort of get the positive reinforcement and say, hey, I did it consistently 2 days a week. Now I'm ready to do it 3. The problem is, like, say with exercise, if you start as your New Year's resolution as 5 days a week, most people aren't going to be able to hit that target, no matter how well-intentioned they are, because life gets in the way. And so what happens is they completely give up. It becomes an all or nothing thing. Instead, start small and then build up, because the mindset shift is, look at me, I'm a rock star. I said I was going to do 2 and I'm doing 3, rather than I said I was going to do 5 and now I'm doing 3.
Gosh, yeah, I love that so much. I was like, I know the 4 M's. I do the movement, mindfulness, meaningful interactions, but mastery, I love mastery so much, because I can tell you, I recently took up gardening. We moved to a house in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and there is something about being in that flow state with no agenda, with no sort of desire to necessarily prove anything to anyone. It's for the pure love of it and wanting to get better at something. And there is something so soothing when you're on the other side of that. I mean, it can be uncomfortable and challenging, which is good. But then, you know, yeah, I don't think we have enough of that in our modern times, where everything is so agenda driven. So
yes, yes. And performance driven, right? And that's so hard. And I remember giving a talk at a high school, and this was one of the exercises that I asked them to all sort of like break up into small groups and do this. And it was so interesting. Like, this woman, when we talked about the takeaways, and that was what stuck with her, was like doing something. She goes, I feel like everything I'm doing is to get into an Ivy League college. Like, it's like, and it's sad, because we're not people anymore, right? If everything has an agenda.
Absolutely. So great. So a couple more questions before I let you go. Social media, the elephant in the room. I mean, clips from this podcast will be on social media. I'm on social media. We all try to spread a positive message of health and wellness on social media, but I am fully aware that there's a dark side to social media. Do you have tips for people on how to navigate social media without it negatively affecting their mental health?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, just being intentional and being aware of, oh, wow, this could be why, if I'm feeling bad, if my mood is low. I think it's really important to check in with yourself every week, maybe not every day, but every week, to be like, how am I feeling? And what are the feelings? Am I feeling less than? Because I think one of the most common feeling is this idea that any variations of FOMO, of I am missing out, or I'm being left out. So is it in the social arena that you're feeling left out, right? Is it that, oh, your friends are getting together, or these people are getting together and you're not, and you're being excluded? Is that what is bothering you? Is it the fact that these people are going on nice vacations and trips? Is that what's bothering you? Is it the career success that you wish that you had obtained and thought you would have checked those boxes? And is that what's bothering you? Is it family that people are having, getting married, getting engaged, having babies, buying houses, which aspect? Because there's so many layers. And really, to me, what it says is this an area of your life that you want to develop and cultivate, right? So you can use it as information to say, is there something missing that I want to be spending more time in? Because I think what social media does is it makes us passive. It's the snacking part where you feel like you've had your interaction with the person because you've been, you know, sometimes like you'll watch a friend's video and you'll be like, oh, I know what's going on. I know where they are. They traveled here, here, here. Now their baby looks like this. Their dog looks like this. I don't need to call them. I have gotten my fill. And so we're not actually reaching out. We're not actually asking them how they're doing. We're not actually meeting them because we feel like we know everything about them or our favorite influencer. But finding out what are the common themes that tend to come up for you. And then also being limiting, trying to limit your time on it. Like I have put in, you know, now I'm promoting, you know, the book and I'm talking about it. So I'm on Instagram more and connecting with people more. But I do have a timer set, you know, for 1 hour. So it kicks me off. And then if I choose to stay longer, it says, do you want to go on for 15 more minutes? Do you want to ignore it for the rest of the day? Do you want to get off? And that's helpful just because then I ask myself to be intentional. What am I on here for? What am I looking for? So it's really hard to tell people to get off because it has allowed, it's expanded our worlds and allowed us to connect with people. But I would say the time to be mindful, the emotions, what is it bringing up for you? And then could it be something you could do in real life to say, you know what, I'm inspired by how much this person has done and has accomplished. Maybe that's what I want for myself. Okay, what can I do? Let me get off and let me think of action steps to do that.
I love that so much. What you're saying is use some of the negative emotions that may come up when you're on social media as information as to areas of your own life that may need attention, but then also be really mindful about your time on social. I recently saw a study that looked at, I think, college students that were asked to restrict their time on social media to 30 minutes a day versus, you know, people who were kids who were allowed to just use as much of it as they wanted. And there was a substantial improvement in many markers of mental health just by limiting your time. So you can have it kind of like, you know, the fun foods that we all like or the chocolate or whatever, the treats. But we all know that if we go overboard, there are negative consequences. So have limits. Yeah.
Yes. And you know what you're saying with the college students and even like younger kids, when the benefit of limiting it is the problem is the excessive social media use, especially they found like in young girls, teens, and that over like 3.5 hours was considered excessive. What was happening was not only are you getting a lot of images that are body image related or otherwise that could be harmful for or cyberbullying, but also that it was taking away from sleep, exercise, and in real life connection. So ask yourself, because when you shrink the time, then it frees up more space to actually do this one-on-one. So ask yourself, am I feeling bad because social media has taken away other positive things in my life? And then I would say to schedule in the 4 M's to make sure that fine, if you're doing your social media, that's fine, but never let it be at the expense of these important habits that need to be in place.
Yeah. Really quickly, I want to talk about hustle culture. So I love that term that you used in the beginning. How do we embrace sort of healthy hustle? Because, you know, many of us are trying to launch projects and work hard on things. So I don't want to make all hustle seem bad. Like hustle can be enhancing in some cases, just like stress can be enhancing in some cases. But then we know too much is super detrimental. Do you have any tips or actions in your book to kind of manage this hustle culture?
Yeah. So I would say, you know, look at the timeline, because a lot of times the hustle is self-imposed. No one is telling us that you need to achieve this by this date. And we have these sort of arbitrary, rigid standards that are self-imposed, like this 30 under 30 list or this, you know, Forbes 40 under 40, whatever. And forget that. Drop that timeline, because the reality is things will happen when you are ready for them to happen and when the universe is ready for them to happen. Combined. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes is like, luck is preparation met by opportunity. So just realize that anything you're doing, if it hasn't exploded and, you know, fully come to fruition or gone viral, so to speak, yet, it's totally fine because you're continuing to prepare, you know, and you're making deposits into this bank account of success. And so first of all, I would say, look at the timeline. Is it realistic? Is it manageable? Who imposed it? If it's self-imposed, can it be expanded to say, all right, is this a one-year plan? Is this a five-year plan? What would happen? What would change? Ask yourself this one question. what positive, what good would I be doing for my mental health, for my sanity, for the people who love me, if I shifted my timeline by a time and a half? What would it look like if I doubled it? What would I say if I tripled it, right? So, you know, I was talking to a friend who's an author, and she's writing a book right now, and she's like, oh my God, Sue, I thought it would be a 2-year thing. It's turning into a 4-year thing, right? But I know when it's done, I'm sure it will be amazing. Same thing with me. The book took longer than it was supposed to. There was tons of research that I did. So be flexible with your timeline. And this idea of, like, you know, write your purpose in pen, but your path in pencil. So the idea of how you approach a goal, be flexible with that, right? Like, know what you want. Like, I've had patients who are like, I want to help people. And then they may try to go to medical school and, let's say, or become a scientist, and it didn't work out. So I was like, okay, can we pivot? And can you think of other ways to meet the same goal? So be open to pivoting also in how you achieve your larger purpose in life. And be, I would say, give yourself grace and compassion, because this is a long, you have to look at success as a long-term gain. And part of that success is taking care of your mental health. There is no health without mental health. And I can tell you that firsthand, because my opening chapter will tell you about my own blind spots and how I came to therapy, how I came to this whole pathway that has given me more than I ever asked for. But it's because I'm trying, not always, I'm a work in progress, trying to be mindful of my thoughts and my mental health. And then I would say, how do you define success, right? And getting very granular about that. And it's totally okay to say success to me looks like fill in the blank, X amount of money in my bank account, these material goals, having achieved X, Y, and Z. And so, but if you can be flexible to say, all right, these are goals, but they're not necessities, and breaking down the needs and the wants, you know, whether it is needs and wants materially or needs and wants accomplishment wise. Because sometimes, again, arbitrary, rigid, I must make this list. Okay, well, what does the list mean? What is it going to open up for you? And really what you're saying is, for a lot of people, awards and accolades means more opportunity, right? And to me, what I have always valued when I thought of success, I think of success for me, just me personally, is freedom. Freedom to choose the projects that I want, freedom to work with whom I want, when I want, how I want, the timeline that I want. And so, is that really what you're looking for? You know, and then how do you achieve that? So think of what the underlying thing is. Sure, money is great. Sure, accolades are great. Sure, all of the surface level stuff. But really, for me, what I wanted is what's underneath it is to have freedom, to have my day the way I imagined it, you know, so, and to be able to spend time. And, you know, and even if you, you know, entrepreneurs, they also themselves don't have that much freedom, right? Because if you want to succeed, even if it's your own business, you're working 24/7, you know, I have certain things on my mind from morning to night. So there's pluses and minuses, and maybe getting mentorship or having a really good group of, I would say, like, advisory board in your life, your peers, you know, from maybe different backgrounds. I think that's really helpful for me, because I have friends who are in media, who are in medicine, you know, who do different things, and I'm always learning from them. So I think having a good support system of maybe women from different backgrounds who have different expertise, who can see the same thing that you're doing, but from, because all of us now are multi-hyphenate, right? We all have different hats that we wear. All of us have to be good in communication, in writing, in content creation, plus our day jobs. So I think it's helpful to have a little group of people that you can run things by.
So helpful. So Radical Vitality is the name of this podcast. And I always like to ask my guests, what is one kind of non-negotiable daily practice, daily habit that you engage in that you feel gives you this sense of radical vitality in your life?
You know, it's in some ways connecting to my spirituality in some way, or a higher power, but it's not in the typical sense. Like, some days it might be nature, like walking in nature, like walking for me is non-negotiable. And some days it's journaling. Some days it's, there's a book that I love. It's called Wherever You Go, There You Are by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And I keep that book by my bedstand that was given to me years ago as a gift. And I've gifted it to so many people. And it really is like, you know, it's a psychologist, you know, sort of written by somebody in Western science and medicine who took in a lot of Eastern wisdom. And the passages are just so beautiful, one page each. So I think every day it's different, but it's something that takes me outside of myself, outside of my own head, and allows me to feel small, you know? And I think, like, this idea of awe is so important, because when we get consumed by ourselves, we become so self-absorbed, and all of us are so self-absorbed, whether it's on our, for ourselves or for our families. And what we need more of is opportunities to get outside of our head and to have what I call like emotional oneness or a sense of collective unity that we belong to something greater, whether it's the human family, whether it's Earth. So recognize that you're just one piece in this greater cosmos.
So beautifully said. Mic drop. I don't need to say anything after that. What a beautiful note to end on. And thank you so much, Sue. You've shared so much wisdom and so many actionable takeaways. And I know the book is packed with even more of those practical, actionable takeaways. I can't wait to have a my copy on my nightstand, and I hope everyone will go grab a copy of Practical Optimism. So where can people find you on the interwebs? Of course, they can order your book wherever books are sold. It's called Practical Optimism. And where else can people find you if they want to learn more?
Yeah, so they can find me on my Instagram, which is Dr. Sue Varma, the word doctor, and that's where I'm most often. And my website is drsuevarma.com. I have blogs there that I'm writing about all sorts of things that are, you know, in the news or topical or pertinent or on our mind these days. And then there's a newsletter that you can subscribe to that I hope to have up and running at some point.
And we will put links to the website, the book, the blogs, and everything in the show notes. And thank you so much again for coming on. I hope we can do part two of this conversation. Good luck with the book. And thank you again.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to the Radical Vitality Podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss a new episode. It's also the best way to support the show at no cost to you. If you'd like to share your thoughts or feedback, let me know by rating and reviewing the show on your favorite listening app or leaving me a comment on YouTube. Until next time, stay spicy, stay healthy.